This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. Tis the season for overeating and not getting enough exercise, but lest we fall prey to the illusion that we can pop a pill to make up for our bad behavior, this week on the Compass we reprise a story we did several years ago on the pills more and more Americans are hoping will fend off the ill effects of an unhealthy lifestyle. And then correspondent Martha Baskin looks at the question of what place natural gas has in plans for a clean energy future. So now, let's go inside the Compass. With the aging demographics of Jefferson County, where the median age is now 52, the odds are very good that you or somebody dear to you is using one of the powerful cholesterol-lowering drugs, collectively known as statins, which, with annual sales in the tens of billions of dollars, are by far the biggest-selling pharmaceuticals of all time. The drug industry has consistently touted the safety and benefits of statins and pushed steadily to have what was originally conceived to be for the use only of those at high risk of heart disease approved by the FDA as a general preventative. There was even serious talk not too long ago of adding it to the water supply like fluoride. But since the first statin was introduced in 1987, a growing number of problems with the drugs have surfaced, including multiple deaths from a rare muscle-wasting disease. One version of the drug was pulled from the market when some 52 deaths were attributed to it. Nonetheless, prescribing statins continues to be standard treatment for elevated levels of LDL, the so-called bad cholesterol, and doctors who fail to follow the guidelines by prescribing it are liable for malpractice suits. With the powerful pharmaceutical industry watching out for its commercial interests, doctors have been reluctant to express worries they may have about the steady expansion in use of what some are starting to consider a dangerous drug. But some have started to speak out. One of those is Dr. Barbara H. Roberts, director of the Women's Cardiac Center at Miriam Hospital in Rhode Island, whose book, The Truth About Statins, Risks and Alternatives to Cholesterol-Lowering Drugs, was published last year by Pocket Books. In the introduction to her book, Dr. Roberts wrote that, in exposing the shoddy science that underlies many of the guidelines that doctors are told they must follow in treating their patients, and in exposing the rampant conflicts of interest among the FDA, Big Pharma, medical scientists, medical centers, and professional medical organizations, I risk being declared a pariah in the medical community. In the phone interview, I asked Dr. Roberts why she decided to take that risk.
What made me decide to write this book was my sense of outrage when the FDA in February of 2010 expanded the indications for treating healthy people with statins. And this was based on a study called the Jupiter trial, which I considered to be a very flawed trial. What it basically did was expand the indications such that millions of more people could potentially be put on statin medications with very little evidence that the benefit would outweigh the risks. And the longer statins have been in use, it's become more and more clear that they have more serious side effects and more side effects, period, than was initially thought. For example, it wasn't until February of 2012 that the FDA came out with a black box warning telling people that taking statins can increase your risk of developing diabetes.
Right, yes, I read about
that. And when you think that healthy people are being put on a drug to prevent heart disease, but it may cause diabetes, which is one of the strongest risk factors for heart disease, something doesn't compute.
What kind of process did you go through yourself? I mean, you have quite a few case studies in here, and some of them really quite horrific, of people coming down with really severe effects very quickly after starting to take the drug. But I mean, when statins first came out, were you like most other doctors and just sort of blithely prescribing them?
Well, I tried to always prescribe them when I thought they were indicated. And when they were first released, we knew that they were very effective in lowering LDL, the so-called bad cholesterol, but what we weren't really sure was whether doing so would decrease the incidence of heart disease. Because the first statin to be released by or approved by the FDA in this country was lovastatin, and that was in 1987. And it really wasn't until the early 90s that clinical trials started to come out showing that if you give statins to people who have established vascular disease, you can slightly lower their risk of having, you know, heart attacks and, in some studies, dying of heart disease. So statins were not as heavily marketed when they first came out because we really didn't have the evidence from randomized controlled clinical trials that they were beneficial. But over the years, as more and more trials of this nature were done at tremendous cost, I might say, there were some trials, not all, but some trials showing that statins lowered the risk of having future events in people with heart disease. And then there were also what are called primary prevention trials, where you give statins to people who don't have established vascular disease but are at high risk for whatever reason. And some of those showed benefit. But interestingly enough, in primary prevention, the benefit was much less than it was in people with established vascular disease, and there was no benefit in women.
You had a very interesting passage in here that talked about how in the advertising about the drugs, they talk about relative results as opposed to absolute results. And I wonder if you could go into that a little bit, because that's very interesting.
For example, if you look at all the primary prevention trials, so the biggest primary prevention trials in men, so you're treating healthy men, what you do is you compare the percentage of events in the men on statins compared to the percentage in the men on placebo. If you look at the absolute risk reduction, so just say, for example, that 3% of the people in the placebo group had what we call an endpoint, either heart attack, stroke, death, need for revascularization, and 1.5% of the people in the statin group did, which is, and these numbers are not out of the range of possibility, then the absolute risk reduction is 3 minus 1.5.
Which is 1.5, right.
But the relative risk reduction is 3 minus 1.5, or 50%. So when you read the results of these trials, they always give the relative risk reduction. They don't give the absolute risk reduction.
So when I see that I have a 50% less chance of having a heart attack, I say, well, that's a really good deal. I think I'll take this. But in fact, my risk has only been reduced by 1.5%.
Right. Yes. There are certain guidelines that doctors are supposed to follow, but the drug companies have been very misleading in the way they sell the drugs to both the lay public and to doctors. Most doctors don't have the time to read these studies very, very carefully. And the guidelines, for example, say that the optimal level of bad cholesterol is under 100. But that's not what the guidelines say is the number that you have to get everybody to. The guidelines say that you have to figure out what the risk of that particular patient is. And there are five other risk factors other than cholesterol that are taken into effect. And that if you have 0 to 1 other risk factors, then your goal for your bad cholesterol is under 160, not under 100. But some doctors just say, oh, here's someone whose LDL is over 100. Here, take a statin.
But now let's talk a little bit about cholesterol because, you know, cholesterol has a really bad rep now. Everybody thinks, oh, well, cholesterol causes heart attacks. But indeed, it's an essential element to our well-being, right? I mean, perhaps you could
talk
a little
bit. Absolutely. We couldn't survive without cholesterol. Every cell in our body contains cholesterol. It's an integral part of the membrane that surrounds every cell in our body. It's needed for the manufacture of many hormones, including the sex hormones and the adrenal cortical hormones. It's needed for digestion. It's used in the manufacture of bile acids. It's absolutely crucial for the proper functioning of our brain and nervous system. In fact, 25% of the cholesterol in our bodies is found in our brain. And statins interfere with a rate-limiting step that's very early on in the synthetic pathway that leads to cholesterol. And so when you interfere with the production of cholesterol, you also interfere with the production of all of the things that require cholesterol in order to be synthesized.
I see. And one of the things you talk about in the book is the enzyme CoQ10, and perhaps you could tell a little bit about that.
Right. CoQ10 is important in little organelles in the body called mitochondria. They're found in every cell in our body, and they're like the energy factories of our cells. and CoQ10 is very integral to the proper functioning of the mitochondria, and CoQ10 is in that same synthetic pathway. And so people who take statins can lower their CoQ10 levels by more than 50%. And some people feel that the muscle pain and the muscle damage that is so common in people who take statins is due to deficiencies in CoQ10. But whether or not giving people extra CoQ10 is really beneficial in preventing that muscle damage hasn't been really worked out yet.
Perhaps you could also elucidate for us the difference between bad and good cholesterol. I mean, like, so LDL has a bad rap and HDL is good. I mean, so what's good about good and what's bad about bad?
Well, you know, cholesterol is a waxy substance. And if you ever tried to dissolve wax in water, it doesn't happen. So cholesterol circulates in our blood, which is mostly water, bound to special proteins called lipoproteins. What we've realized as a result of multiple epidemiologic studies, starting out with the Framingham study that started in the late 1940s in Framingham, Mass., is that if you have high levels of cholesterol in your blood, you're at increased risk of having hardening of the arteries, what we call atherosclerosis.
That was a correlation that was made. And
it's a correlation, right? And it's not a very strong correlation. There are other things that are far stronger risk factors, like, for example, smoking, like high blood pressure, like diabetes. And many things play a role. Inflammation, we now know, plays a role. Sedentary lifestyle, being obese. So cholesterol is just one player, and it's a relatively minor player. The reason we think it's so important is that pharmaceutical companies have waged a huge campaign to demonize cholesterol and make everybody think that they have to knock their cholesterol way down. And that's just not true. And particularly in women, high levels of the bad cholesterol are not a particularly strong risk factor at all. I was engaged in a study with a young doctor at the NIH where we followed over 2,000 women between the ages of 40 and 64 for 19 years. And even at LDL, this over 190, there was no significant increase in a woman's risk of dying of heart disease.
So there's a really big difference between men and women.
Yes. In women, really the only important number is the level of the good cholesterol. And the good cholesterol helps protect you against developing heart disease. It acts as can remove cholesterol from plaque. It acts as an antioxidant, and it's the oxidized form of LDL cholesterol that can initiate the formation of plaque substance. And LDL has anti-inflammatory properties and anti-clotting properties.
Perhaps you could list some of the side effects that we're talking about here.
Well, the most common side effect in people who take statins is muscle pain. I mentioned in the book that my own husband was put on a statin years ago by his primary care doctor, and he developed severe muscle pain. And even though the muscle enzymes were normal, he was tried on a different statin. And over the years, he's been put on every statin that ever has been released by the FDA. And every one of them caused muscle pain. So we used to say, well, if you have muscle pain on a statin, we'll check your muscle enzyme. It's called a CPK. And if the CPK was normal, we would tell people, well, don't worry about it. Your CPK is normal. Your muscles aren't being damaged. Well, it turns out there have now been studies done of people who develop muscle pain on statins and have normal CPKs, but their muscle biopsies still show evidence of damage. The most severe form of muscle damage, called rhabdomyolysis, occurs very rarely, but when it does occur, it can be fatal. And there was one particular statin that was taken off the market in 2001 called Bakol, and there were more than 30 fatal cases of rhabdomyolysis from Bakol in the United States alone.
Now, if you have this muscle damage caused by the statin drugs and then go off the statins, does the damage reverse itself?
Usually it does, but there are people who are left chronically incapacitated with muscle pain. The other thing we are seeing more and more of is damage to nerves, what we call neuropathy. And I've had two people who were not put on statins by me, but came to me after statins were prescribed by other doctors, who developed such severe neuropathy that they wound up essentially paralyzed and unable to walk. And it took them months, if not years, to recover. And there have been studies that have shown in other countries that if you take statins, you increase your risk of damage to multiple nerves 14-fold.
Now, you also talk about cognitive damage and memory loss.
Yes. Cognitive dysfunction has been described from statins. And again, last February, for the first time, the FDA mentioned that there is a possibility of cognitive dysfunction. And I've seen this again in multiple patients of mine.
You actually mentioned one case. It was an attorney who was one of the ones I was referring to before who had a very mm-hmm. quick negative response to the statins.
He was someone who heard about my interest in this and got in touch with me. He wasn't actually a patient of mine. He's someone I interviewed and someone who sent me his medical records so I could review them. But another story was written by a patient of mine who's a professor at an Ivy League university who also developed severe muscle pain and weakness and cognitive dysfunction to the point where he couldn't do his research, couldn't supervise his fellows. Luckily, he did make a complete recovery.
Well, so you actually have a list of questions in your first chapter that you say, mm-hmm. you know, if your doctor is telling you should go on the statins, that you should really ask. Could you go over those for us?
There is a difference if you're a man or a woman. As I said, if you're a woman who doesn't have established vascular disease, then there's no evidence that putting you on a statin will lower your risk of having a cardiac event. The only exception I make to that is a very rare syndrome called familial hypercholesterolemia. In these families, if you have one dose of the gene, your bad cholesterol may be in the range of 300 to 600. And in those people, they have a really increased, even the women, have an increased risk of developing premature heart disease. And if they can tolerate statins, statins seem to be effective, although the disease is so rare that we really don't have any randomized controlled trials in that syndrome. But if you are the average person, what your doctor needs to do is to look at what other risk factors you have. And those other risk factors include cigarette smoking, high blood pressure, a low level of good cholesterol. By low, I mean under 40 in men and under 50 in women. A family history of premature coronary heart disease, and your age. And the age at which you become at increased risk for coronary heart disease is 45 and over in men and 55 and over in women. Now, if you have an HDL, a good cholesterol, of 60 or more, that allows you to subtract one risk factor. Uh-huh. So if you have 0 to 1 risk factor, your LDL goal is under 160. If you have 2 or more risk factors, your LDL goal is under 130. And if you have established coronary heart disease or its equivalent, and diabetes is considered an equivalent, then your LDL goal is under 100 with that optional goal of under 70 if you have established vascular disease and multiple risk factors.
I've told you earlier that I was actually told to go on the statin drugs about a decade ago, but managed with diet and exercise to basically totally turn the picture around, although I must admit that my LDL remains at about 161. Mm-hmm. So I'm still not going on the statin drugs.
No. I would suspect that if that's your only risk factor, you don't need to be on a statin, because the guidelines say that's the goal, and put someone on drug if their LDL is over 190. In other words, if you have 0 to 1 risk factors other than your LDL, your goal is under 160, you need to be on a drug if you're level is over 190.
Well, then actually a few years later, I was found to be a type 2 diabetic before I'd really, addressed the issue. And mm-hmm. it was actually when I got that diagnosis that I really began working on it. And it was then mm-hmm. that I managed to pull all of my risk factors down. And so my fasting glucose is like under 100 regularly. And, you know, so.
Right. So now you're probably not diabetic.
So I'm sort of suggesting one of the things that people can try here to lower their cholesterol. But I know that you have advice about that, and perhaps you could give some of it here.
Yes. You know, as I said, cholesterol is not really as important as the overall healthy lifestyle. And the healthiest diet is a plant-based Mediterranean-type diet. It's not a low-fat diet. There's lots of olive oil in the Mediterranean diet, but it's a plant-based diet incorporating seafood and very little meat. I tell my patients, treat meat as a condiment, not an entree. And we have evidence that the Mediterranean diet lowers your risk of having heart attacks and dying of heart disease more than any statin. And this is a study called the Lion Diet Heart Trial, which I mentioned in the book, in which over 600 people who had survived a heart attack were randomized to either the Mediterranean diet or the American Heart Association so-called prudent low-fat diet. And they were followed for almost 4 years. And they had a 56% relative risk reduction in the Mediterranean diet group for total mortality, which is unheard of. It's, you know, better than any statin trial. They had a 65% reduction in cardiac mortality. They had a 70% relative risk reduction in recurrent heart attack. They even had a 61% lower risk of developing cancer. And when you look at the LDLs at the end of that trial, there was almost no difference. And remember I said that the goal is under 100 if you have established vascular disease? Well, the LDL in the Mediterranean diet group was 161, and in the prudent diet group was 164. So they got these tremendous beneficial results of the diet with really no difference in the LDL levels. But this diet is an anti-inflammatory diet. It's an antioxidant diet. It's an anti-diabetes diet. And when you combine that with maintaining a normal body weight, not smoking, exercising regularly, you can lower your risk far more than you can with any statin. My mother, like me, had a cholesterol around 300 every time it was checked. She lived to be 88, and she didn't die of heart disease, and she never took a statin. My oldest patient will be 104 next month. Her LDL cholesterol is over 160. Her primary care doctor tried to put her on a statin when she was 96. I said, absolutely not. And I have another patient who I've been following since 1985 when she had her first heart attack. She could never tolerate a statin, so basically she never took a statin. She's now 94, and she hasn't had another heart attack. So it's not all about the LDL.
Once again, Dr. Roberts' book is titled The Truth About Statins, Risks and Alternatives to Cholesterol-Lowering Drugs, and was published in 2012 by Pocket Books. This is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community News.
When it comes to whether greenhouse gas-emitting fossil fuels like oil and coal have a role in the region's clean energy future, government and non-oil and coal interests agree with environmental allies. They don't. But add another fossil fuel to the mix, natural gas, which climate activists call fracked gas, and there are differences of opinion. A panel at the Northwest Clean and Affordable Energy Conference exposed some of the differing points of view.
I don't think natural gas has a role in a clean energy future because it's not clean.
Tarika Powell with Sightline, a progressive policy think tank, was one of three panelists.
Natural gas is simply less dirty, and it's very important to be able to make that distinction between something that is less dirty and something that's actually clean.
Natural gas extraction has changed, says Powell. It used to mean install a pipeline in a well and watch the gas flow. Now it means using millions of gallons of saline water and chemicals to extract it from geological formations. The toxic water migrates and contaminates the water supply of nearby communities. Two-thirds of gas is fracked in the U.S. In Canada, it's half, but is expected to increase 80% by 2035. Gas in the Pacific Northwest comes from the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin and Rocky Mountain Basin. Both basins have very high fracking activity, says Powell.
The Rocky Mountain Basin is the number one fracking site in the U.S.
Data on just how much is fracked is not publicly available. An additional point many are unaware of, says Powell, is that natural gas is primarily composed of methane, a powerful greenhouse gas. By some accounts, methane is 87 times more potent at trapping heat in the atmosphere than CO2.
So the last thing we want to do is introduce an even more powerful heat-trapping gas into the atmosphere as we are facing a climate crisis.
Methane leaks are common during the entire supply chain, from extraction to delivery of gas. All the panelists at the Northwest Clean and Affordable Energy Conference agree that decarbonization in the energy sector needs to happen. Unlike Powell, some think there's a low-carbon path for natural gas. Take Bill Edmonds with Northwest Natural, one of three gas utilities in the state of Oregon. He says natural gas, in his words, is an energy-efficient workhorse, especially during peak winter months. Edmund says it's important to ask how existing infrastructure, pipes in the ground, can be used to drive down emissions. Northwest Natural has a three-step plan: lower the carbon intensity of the product, help customers use less product through energy efficiency.
And how do we displace higher carbon fuels, namely getting dirty diesel off the road and replacing it with either natural gas or renewable natural gas?
The utility is working with the city of Portland to produce renewable gas as a byproduct from the city's sewage treatment plant. Portland currently flares the methane released from the gas.
Instead of that, they're going to capture that methane. They're going to put it in trucks right on site as renewable natural gas to displace diesel. And they're going to put all the remainder of the renewable natural gas they produce onto our pipeline so that it can go to customers.
Northwest Natural has replaced older pipes made of cast iron and bare steel with newer poly and coated pipes to eliminate leaks. Tony Usabelli, energy and climate advisor with the state's Department of Commerce, another panelist, says the state will not meet 80% carbon reduction goals by 2050. Transportation, mainly single-occupancy vehicles powered by gas and diesel, is the biggest hurdle and contributes the lion's share of the state's greenhouse gas emissions. While hydro supplies 67% of electricity, the remainder comes from natural gas, oil, nuclear power, and coal. Usabelli agrees with Northwest Natural's Bill Edmonds that the state may need to rely on natural gas during peak winter months. But he says energy efficiency is the real solution. Analysis by the Northwest Power and Conservation Council shows that for the next 20 years,
the region can really meet all of its energy requirements by investment in cost-effective conservation. And that is both the lowest cost and the lowest risk resource.
Usabelli says the state hasn't fully analyzed the climate implications of all aspects of gas. Sightlines Tarika Powell says renewables are underestimated, yet continue to outperform projections, particularly solar and wind. Last year, renewables rose to 14% of electricity generation in the U.S.
That was a 9% increase in just 1 year. If we could continue to increase between 5 and 9% for the next decade, we could be at a place where we are looking at a grid that is predominantly powered by renewables.
The Northwest Energy Coalition, who sponsored the Clean and Affordable Energy Conference, support a transition to a clean and renewable energy system in which coal plays no role and natural gas has a minimal role. At the same time, they believe no new natural gas infrastructure should be introduced in the Northwest. A Sightline report, Northwest Projects Fuel the Fracking Beast, cites multiple gas projects in the region fueled by Canada's fracking industry. Projects include Puget Sound Energy Pipeline expansion and their backing of an LNG plant in Tacoma, and a massive methanol export plant that would consume staggering amounts of water, a plan initially favored by the governor. Clean energy advocates appear to have their work cut out for them. Martha Baskin. This story was brought to you with support from the Human Links Foundation, engineering by Daniel Gunther, music by Steve Griggs, produced through the Jack Straw Artist Support Program.
This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans and Martha Baskin. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.